Hi guys, welcome to Rewatchable episode 70. We're going to be covering Avatar: The Last Airbender episodes 9, The Waterbending Scroll, and 10, Jet. As always, you can get in touch with us via email at rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com, our Twitter, which is at re_watchable, or you can leave feedback and comments on this post on hyperball.com. And I'm so excited because I love everyone who's on the episode today. So, yay! I have Karen and Mitchell and Michal. And I'm so happy about this. I love all you guys.
And who are
Say
you?
hi. Rude. Wow. First the mushrooms, then the ranking of the doctors, and now this, Karen. I am the most betrayed by you that I have ever been. Wow.
It's odd that I still got like every single reference you just threw out there because I knew it like came from like Karen's love of mushrooms to probably something on NHWP and then
Yeah, basically, Karen's order of like ranking the doctors in Doctor Who is pretty much the exact opposite of mine out of the new doctors. The exact opposite.
I mean, nobody can be perfect, Danya, so it's nice
Yeah,
that you
that.
tried.
Oh, I'm gonna run away with Marima because Marima understands me. Okay. Cool. Did everyone else say hi before Karen and I decided to have a very public falling out?
I think Recall's still trying to recover from the Korra season 3 finale
I'm not
that
really
stuff.
listening to you guys. I'm just thinking about that one little thing that Mitch left out of the recap, even though it was very, very, very amazing of you to take it over for me because I way underestimated my time. You
I was
forgot
curious
the
what's.
last shot. The last shot.
Don't reference it any
I
other
know.
I can't think of what it is. I
There's
thought it.
gifts all over the place.
I thought I included it. I thought it was like where I said I cried right in the end.
Oh, okay. I see.
So I
It's okay.
did,
It's
right?
not, no, it's not like super important. It's just like that image is like haunting me and I see
Oh,
it
it's
when I
of a
close my
certain
eyes.
someone crying. Okay,
Yeah.
yes. Yes, okay, yes. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Oh,
So
upsetting.
I'm gonna be watching it tomorrow. Like my days
Oh
off are
my God.
so precious and so far apart and I have to fill so much into them. It's crazy. But I'm watching it tomorrow because it's a bank holiday, so I get the day off.
I went as far as saying to like friends that I was talking to, it was better than any season I've seen of any of the series. I thought it was so tight and just so worth it. Like what we're watching now leads up to everything that happens in that season of Korra, and it's gonna be fantastic if
No,
everyone's watching for the first time, they
stop.
get to that.
No more Korra talk. It's making me like. It's very
Oh.
strange, by the way, to me that Karen is actually in a position to spoil you, Danya, on since
No,
she
don't give
hasn't
her
seen
any
most of
ammo. We
Atlan.
no, we've fallen out now, so she could totally use that against me. Don't tell her that.
Oh dear, I'm sorry.
It's not like I didn't figure that on my own beforehand.
I mean, Karen, it must be horrible because you've been like, I think, editing at all the Friday night recaps that McCall and I have been posting for Korra. So it's honestly like you probably do know more than any newbie on this show. I have to say at least that much, wouldn't you say?
Well, not really, because there's such a disconnect for me between Avatar and Korra that, like, because I don't know what happened in between, I pretty much have the beginning of Avatar and the end of Korra that it's sort of like, well, there are names that I recognize, but that's about it. I don't really know what's happened, so I'm still pretty in the dark.
Yeah, I think a lot of those things probably seem like really obvious to us who have watched the series multiple times and like know all these things. But to you, it's probably like I'm aware that there's a connection, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah, I'm just hoping that when there are like characters that appear again, you're not like they survived or like whatever else, because that would make me really sad,
Cool. Right, let's actually move on. To the recap.
Simpler
So we'll move on.
time.
Yeah, we'll move on to episode 9, The Waterbending Scroll. And let's go over the synopsis. So in this episode of Avatar The Last Airbender, Aang expresses an interest in learning how to waterbend from Katara. He soon overcomes his master, creating a giant wave with ease. This shocks Katara, who says that she still can't do such advanced bending. The gang heads into town and comes upon a pirate shop. While Aang tries to haggle with two copper pieces, Katara steals a rare waterbending scroll, justifying it by saying that the pirates stole it from the Northern Water Tribe. A chase ensues, and Aang air glides the gang off into a water oasis. Katara and Aang practice a water whip technique, with Aang exceeding it enough to make Katara furious. Feeling remorse at her reaction, she apologizes and gives Aang the scroll. Meanwhile, Uncle Iroh is on a quest to buy a missing Paisho tile, leading him and Zuko hot on the trail of the Avatar, thanks to the help of the pirates. Katara secretly practices the new bending at night and is caught by Zuko and co. Aang and Sokka are also taken hostage. A showdown about the worth of the Avatar versus the waterbending scroll ensues between the pirates and Zuko's party. The gang escapes the scuffle, sailing off on the pirate ship. Right before the gang goes over a giant waterfall, Aang calls Appa on a bison whistle, whisking the Avatar and friends out of harm's way. Wow, there was so much that happened in that episode.
Yes, there was.
yeah, but obviously in this episode we see a lot of Aang kind of picking up waterbending really, really quickly. Do you feel like that's believable considering he's the Avatar, or do you think that it's just them trying to reinforce that he's the Avatar, that's happening?
I think it's believable because he is the Avatar, but I would have liked to have seen him struggle with it at least a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I personally thought it was very believable. Like that, I feel like that's just a thing that happens sometimes. You know, you have somebody who wants to develop skill and then like, they're like working really hard at it, and then their best friend comes along and is like, you know, doing double toe loops on the ice skating rink or something. And like, it was the same kind of thing here. I thought Katara's frustration was really, really realistic. And yeah, I mean, Aang, like, you know, we'll talk later about the various elements and how Aang kind of responds to them. But I think it's pretty clear that he has a kinship with the water tribes and that this is an element that comes more naturally for him. So yeah, that definitely worked for me.
I mean, even through the stances, like in terms of his airbending into waterbending, they're very, very similar. Like in terms of the movements he's making and the flow of it, like it's very, very, it's going to be very light and very fluid. Like, so I think there's a lot of crossover between airbending and waterbending versus airbending and some of the other elements perhaps. So it's a lot more intuitive for waterbending, which I think is potentially why it follows so closely on from airbending in the cycle for learning.
Well, if you think about it, it makes sense that he's already been practicing a type of bending, and Katara has only really been doing it, it seems recently, you know? She's only really able to, like, backwards shoot water and ice behind herself, right? But I mean, Aang is very adept and trained at airbending, and as you're saying, they're very similar. So I guess it makes sense then that, you know, once you kind of get that ball rolling, learn one type of bending, the next isn't going to be as difficult.
Yeah, I mean, and also Katara has and had no teacher, nobody to, like, teach her how to waterbend. So everything that she's got is self-taught versus obviously Aang at least had some kind of training and some kind of idea of bending from the monks before he turned into a capsicle.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's true in terms of like the technicality of it, like overall over the course of the series, and I think, you know, the other series as well, you kind of find that you can bend without like proper form and whatever. Like, I don't know if like the element cares as much about like, you know, you're doing this particular martial arts style, but the people who have better form and are trained usually come out better than people who aren't.
Yeah, I mean, there's a difference between having raw, untapped talent and having that that's kind of honed and trained through to, I guess, to make you the best possible bender that you can be, because it's only so far that Katara is going to be able to go with muddling her way through things. I mean, she's very clearly got a talent for the fact that she's been able to get this far on her own with no one like correcting her form or her stances or anything like that. But obviously with someone to kind of guide her, she could be a lot better. And you see that obviously a little bit through the episode where when Aang is picking it up, he's trying to give back in terms of, well, you want to try and do it by kind of do it like this, be a little bit more fluid and that sort of thing. And even though she gets a little bit frustrated with him, you know, it does help her out in the end when she does kind of get over her hissy fit.
Yeah, I agree. And you're right, we do see a little bit more of her mastery, because she, like you were saying, is essentially being taught or trained from the scroll. She's not exactly getting it all the way, but we're starting to see, I think, some of the beginnings of a great waterbender in Katara. And that's the most we can say on that without spoiling our newbie.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's kind of like someone who is really bad at building IKEA furniture. Like, all of the instructions are there in picture form, but sometimes you end up just taking a nail gun to it.
It was a great metaphor.
Not even to the furniture, to the instructions, you take a nail gun.
Katara does take a nail gun.
I used a nail gun on my IKEA bookcase at one point, because the nail, like, I had, like, it came with nails, and I was like, I have to put the back on this, and you have to nail it. I was just like, well, I have a nail gun in the garage, I could go get that. And I grabbed it, and I was just like, across the back of the bookcase. It was so much faster. Nail guns on IKEA furniture, totally the way forward. But be safe.
Furniture
but bending. Furniture bending. Obviously, going on about Katara, obviously getting the scroll, that's kind of, it's in a very, very kind of gray area in terms of the way that they even get the scroll in the first place. I mean, how do you feel about her basically stealing? But she stole. There's no two ways about it, whether it's from pirates or whether it's from anyone else. She did steal the scroll, you know. How did you guys feel about that?
You know, to me, it's funny. I'm just thinking of a lot of Peter Pan parallels in the next episode we're about to cover, obviously in Pirates, but it feels like something that, like, a Peter Pan or, you know, like that kind of character would do, to steal from the rich, give to the poor. She's essentially, I think, just passing on the knowledge of her people when the pirates were looking to do something, make a quick buck. So I'm sure we're going to delve more into it, but from a face value, I can see where Katara would have done that, but I wouldn't have done it myself, because I see the risk as being a little bit too strong, you know?
How about you? I was going to say, Karen, I want to get your opinion on this.
Yeah, I felt, like, really uncomfortable, actually, when she first did that, and I really wasn't cool with it. And the more I thought about it, the more I was like, okay, yes, she's stealing from pirates who very obviously stole it from the water tribe that they had gotten it from. But at the same time, while what she did wasn't necessarily wrong, because she did steal it from somebody who stole it, it wasn't right either, and I guess I was holding Katara up much higher than maybe she deserved, at least in this episode, because I feel like even if it wasn't wrong to steal that, it wasn't right and she should have known better. I mean, danger aside, like, yeah, that was really dumb trying to, you know, attracting the attention from the pirates when she has Aang there with her and, you know, they're already running from a million different people. I would have hoped that she'd have a better moral compass than to steal anything, regardless of, you know, what, like, if it was a gray area or not.
Yeah, this was the point I was going to bring up, is that the show so far has kind of tried to set Katara up as the moral compass of this show. You're supposed to, I guess, versus like the other characters that we've got, she's supposed to be the pure, the good kind of character, the one who's kind of, I guess goody two shoes is the way to put it. That's the way that she's kind of brought across. But like this episode and kind of through some of the others, like it's starting to thread through that Katara kind of picks and chooses her morals. Yeah. So she kind of picks and chooses them to suit herself while trying to come across and like, this is the right thing, and I say it's the right thing, and I'm the good one, therefore it is right. And it grates on me sometimes, like really badly. Like I kind of go, I get that there's like a gray area, but own up to it. And yeah, she kind of flip-flops back and forth in terms of, is she really doing this for the right reasons, or is she trying to justify it by saying it's for a certain reason and really it's more self-serving than that?
And even at the end, she was like, stealing is wrong unless it's from pirates. And it's like she didn't really learn her lesson by the end of it. And I was saying a few episodes ago how she felt like the perfect one, like she never did anything wrong. And I thought she was kind of boring because of that. I really liked Sokka because he had these very blatant issues and he ended up learning lessons. And, you know, it was always sort of like he was confronted by that. And it wasn't the same with Katara until the last few episodes. And I really started to be like, okay, she's not perfect. She still has her own faults and she's trying to learn from them. So while I liked seeing this side of her, it was nice to see her get angry and be jealous because, you know, hey, she's human. But at the same time, by the end of the episode, I didn't feel like she really learned the lesson that was set out in front of her.
This isn't, you know, my favorite episode in the scheme of things, but I do think it's very interesting in that it does kind of for the first time really, like, I mean, we see little hints of Katara not being perfect, but this is very much sort of, like you said, Danielle, like using herself as the moral compass, you know, so like, I think it's okay, so it is okay. But I mean, it's also interesting in terms of like where Aang and Sokka fall down on this, because Sokka is like full on, who obviously has his own moral issues, but he's full on ready to like be like, no, you did a really dumb and bad thing and that's terrible. And Aang's like, no, it's not your fault. It's okay. And it's really interesting kind of how they all play off each other in that way, I think. You know, and I don't know, as much as, like, it is sort of confusing the way it ends with that tag of, like, ah, hi, it's okay to steal from pirates, yardy yar, that they play that very much as, like, the, you know, oh, the moral end of the episode, but then it's really not. So, you know, which is kind of, I kind of dig that about the show, because it's like, hey, kids, we're going to give you this sort of erroneous moral message, and it's really way more complicated than, like, you know, where we can kind of go into right now. But like when you come back and watch this as adults, you'll totally dig it.
Yeah, I think it sparks a discussion. And I think that's something that Avatar does a lot. It doesn't spoon feed you morals and the right messages sometimes. It makes you get to them yourself. And that's one of the things I really, really love about this show, is that it kind of presents that and then makes you go, well, actually, is that right? Because, I mean, even kids as they are, they'll have been taught that stealing is wrong, full stop. you know, and people do still steal in everyday life. People, like, you see it every day, especially if you work in retail, like I do. You know, it happens, it goes on. But at that age, at the age of, like, who the kids that the show is particularly aimed at, though a lot of older people love it too, case in point. You know, it does make you question it. So
yeah, I mean, I agree. I don't think that, like, we're supposed to think that Katara did the right thing here. Like, her moral arguments are very much, like, secondary. It's like, oh, Aang needs this scroll to learn waterbending. But it's like, you guys are on your way to find a waterbending teacher. Like, time is of the essence, but that wasn't a concern for you 5 minutes ago. You know, Katara definitely, I think, was influenced by feeling subpar, you know, to Aang. And I think that ultimately stealing the scroll was a selfish thing that she could kind of cover up with altruistic motives. And that doesn't make her a terrible person. It makes her human, you know. And I personally find Katara kind of the most relatable when she does stuff like this, you know. She's a little bit like Hermione, like when she steals all the stuff from like Snape's office, right? In chamber. Like, oh, it's totally fine. It's just Snape and whatever. We really need the Polyjuice potion and whatever. And then J.K. Rowling is like, you get turned into a cat.
Well, yeah, I'm thinking of his Accio Horcrux books and how ridiculous that was.
Well, yeah, I mean, even Sokka's kind of standpoint of it, where he's like, you know, you're putting us all at risk with this. I mean, stealing that scroll also makes them more memorable. And they know that Zuko's after them. They know the Fire Nation now knows they're there. And they know that people are looking out for them. So, I mean, making yourself a more memorable person is not the way to be kind of creeping by under the radar. So even twofold, the stealing thing is wrong, but even stealing at, like, kind of the risk of kind of putting a marker on the map for everyone else to aim for, like, they're gonna get closer and closer to you. And, you know, we see that play out in the episode when, because obviously the pirates kind of team up with Zuko on it, because, you know, they're kind of talking in the background when they show up, and they're like, oh yeah, that bald kid and the waterbender. And, you know, considering all airbenders and monks are kind of wiped out at this point, making yourself that memorable is just gonna come, the whole thing comes back to bite them on the ass. So,
and isn't it funny, I mean, that they have so few waterbenders, but Katara doesn't seem to really want to hide that, I guess, as much as Aang does throughout the series, because it's you're right, very defining for her to be waterbending in front of, like, Zuko and gang, but she doesn't seem disturbed by that, and it's almost like she takes a more offensive stance to being a waterbender rather than Aang's defensive of being an airbender. And maybe that comes from the fact that we still have all of the benders with, like, Yue and all that we're going to get into, you know? So it's not like she's the only, but she was the only in her tribe, and that was it. So it's funny to me that there isn't a greater significance that Katara puts on her bending, I suppose. It's kind of just like a humdrum thing that she's like, okay, I do this also, but I'm a person firsthand, you know?
I was just going to say, like, back on the last episode I was on, which was the one where they go to the earthbending prison, and she meets Haru, and all of that happens. Like, she is so, like, forceful with bending is an amazing gift, you should always use it, and you should be doing things with it for good, and you shouldn't be hiding it no matter what. And she really, really, like, forces it through in that episode, and it kind of makes sense that she doesn't hide it, because that's part of her. Yeah. Even though it's a very dangerous thing for the rest of them, because obviously, like, we haven't encountered any other waterbenders as they're going through the rest of the kingdoms. It's kind of that they're very isolated to, the only references we've got so far is obviously the Northern Water Tribe and the Southern Water Tribe, and the way that they make it sound is that they're completely isolated to those two points. So her, like, her pride in her waterbending is amazing, and you should be proud in your, like, you should have pride in your talents and things like that you're very, very good at. But when you're trying to keep yourself kind of under the radar and you don't want to draw attention to yourself, having something that defining about you is something you should like keep a little bit more quiet. And you can still have pride in it, but you need to know when to kind of rein it in a little bit as well. Because even the way that obviously Sokka and Katara dress is very, very kind of iconic to that water tribe kind of look. We don't see anyone else dressed quite like them either. The same with Aang in his gear as well. So they're kind of, they're not really blending in as such. So it's kind of, it was always going to start coming back to them. And it's no wonder that Zuko can continue to just like trail along behind them happily, like, doo, doo, doo. Oh, has someone seen the Avatar? Oh, of course they have, because he's in bright yellow and orange clothing. Kind of thing. I don't know.
Well, something that I think is interesting about that is that I think Katara is still very new mentally to the whole bending idea. You know, like, her, she is really naive in the whole imprisonment thing, imprisoned episode. And I think it follows here that, you know, because she was the only waterbender in her tribe, because, you know, she is really not very good at it, I think it doesn't occur to her at this stage in the game. I don't think it occurs to any of them, actually. I think overall they are all very naive, except maybe for Sokka, and he's not being super smart about this. But like, oh, right, we really stand out, you know, which is something that I think is a theme maybe in the next episode. But I like that they kind of start to wake up to, like, the nastier reality of this, you know?
I mean, yeah, the pirates are kind of, like, that danger that they kind of pose to them is kind of, even aside from bending, is, like, they're a far more dangerous kind of element to this episode. I mean, they're all like very, very interesting kind of characters on their own, but they're all very, very dangerous, and you know, stealing from thieves is never gonna earn you any points. So I mean, how did you guys feel about the pirates in terms of how they were used in this episode as well?
Well, they were a good basis for the starting of a moral compass in Atla, because there are going to be a lot of interesting groups, starting with this episode and especially in the next, where you're forced to take a standpoint as to whether or not they're legitimate in what they do. And I think that the pirates are probably a little bit easier because they're really like, you know, ah, ye scallywag, but then again, like, the gang does steal their ship and throw it over a cliff, you know? So it's like, yes, even if you don't agree with you know, a certain group and what they do, you shouldn't go ahead and steal their possessions and crash their home. Like, that's just taking it a little bit too far, guys, and the respect there is really good, so.
I don't know. The pirates weren't really stand out to me. I don't know if they're meant to be. Obviously, I don't know if they come back or anything, but they were kind of just something that felt like a catalyst to the episode, and they served their purpose, and I didn't really give them a second thought.
I couldn't really like, imagine that there's like this large mob of people forming that just do not like the Avatar. Like, they could kind of be like, I don't know if you guys have ever played like Grand Theft Auto before, but if you go around and you kind of muck around on the streets, and if you punch one person and you run and keep on doing that, you'll eventually have a large mob of people following you trying to get back at you, right? And that's what I imagine that doing right now. Like, there's going to be this large, you know, humongous gang of people just like miserably feeling hatred toward the gang. And I don't blame them, because they kind of, like, they come into a town and they just kind of wreck it, you know?
I mean, you just gave me the title for this episode, by the way. Grand Theft Avatar.
Well, this is the thing. There is kind of a giant... there's a giant group of people who don't like the Avatar and that gang. They're called the Fire Nation. Like, there's a whole kingdom of them right there.
The thing is, like, I don't really like the pirates personally. Like, the more I watch it, the more, like, I do find them funny. I mean, they are funny. Like, that guy, like, we have curios. What are curios? I have no idea, but we have them. I find that amusing. But, as a whole, I mean, like, when the guy pulls out his, like, straight sword and, like, it's like, this is probably the most Western influenced thing in the show to my recollection. And it's just like, obviously this show is not like strictly, you know, everything Eastern or everything blah, blah, blah. But like just seeing that straight sword and like the very typical, like Long John Silver type pirates, I was like, eh.
But I think then even it's slightly more interesting though, when you put it like that, that the more westernized kind of characters or fighting style or mythology and folklore that they're bringing into it, i.e. the pirates, are actually portrayed as the bad guys.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point.
Yeah, so, I mean, you bringing that up, that makes me look at that episode in a different way in terms of like, oh, well, the more westernized characters in that in the pirates are kind of, well, they're seen as the bad guys. So that's a really interesting flip on how we see it through other modern media. I mean, typically, like, even if you look at those, I get them mixed up all the time. There's the two White House movies, and there's one that's about the Koreans. Is that one the one with Channing Tatum? Or is that the one with Jared Butler? I get them mixed up all the time. There's one of them where it's like
the actors?
Yeah, the actors. There's like there's one called White House Down, and then there's one called Olympus Has Fallen.
Yes.
And they came out around the same time. They came out around the same time, but in one of them it's like the Koreans are the bad guys, or like they're even kind of generic Asian kind of bad guys. And that's kind of prevalent through a lot of media, is like depending on racial tensions in our mainstream media and our politics, you see that seeping in through everything else. So I think it's very interesting that the more westernized characters were flipped on and treated as the bad guys in this, because you know what? Sometimes we kind of are the bad guys to a lot of people a lot of the time. So even from a political standpoint, I think that's quite an interesting point to make.
Definitely.
Obviously then Zuko and everyone, they kind of catch up, and Katara kind of toddles off with the waterbending scroll to kind of go practice in the dark, and Zuko catches her and
yeah.
What? Who said that?
Sexy times.
So sexy.
For real, though. It was...
Yeah, it was so bad.
I mean, this is a task for Karen that I'm going to put her on that maybe she'll take up. I loved, like, that little clip taken out, just, like, the audio of it, because it just taken out of context. It was just... I don't know what to make of that. That was just a little bit too much for me, and it didn't make sense. It just... Like, why does he like her that much, if that's what we're getting out of that?
I'll save you from the pirates.
It honestly sounded like, you know, like the meme, I guess, of, like, bad pornos on YouTube where people will just, like, have the intro part, and it'll just be, like, the horrible acting in the beginning. It'll just be, like, your large grapefruits are falling from the tree. And then... That's exactly what this scene reminds me of, unfortunately.
Yeah, I've never seen those either, but I'm really interested in what Karen thought of this little tête-à-tête between Katara.
It definitely caught my eye, because it felt really loaded, and I wasn't quite sure why. But like when he leans forward and he like whispers in her ear, it was like so whoever made the doc, I think Mitch, it was you. You used the word sensual, and I think that that's kind of the perfect word for it. Although I didn't necessarily know where that was coming from, but it, yeah, it felt loaded.
I'm still cracking up over here. I can't. It is too much. That it's just this is a children's show, Nickelodeon. It just didn't. Oh God, I love that. In the last episode, we were teasing some of the fun things that are going to happen, Natalie and I, and then her and I kind of came to the same realization that there are implied sex scenes in Aetla. Complete, like they happened, and you knew they happened.
Really?
Oh yeah, it's like this is just the beginning.
Poker face.
This is bad poker face. I considered this box already open on that aspect because Natalie and I did kind of like rant about that part in the last episode, but I'm assuming Karen didn't listen to it.
We're gonna have to like see how many episodes we can go. Like this podcast has gone for blah 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 number of episodes without mentioning cartoon sex scenes.
Oh man,
that's like the Monsters yeah. counter, you know, like days without an incident, so,
exactly,
like days without an incident.
Right now our count is at zero.
Yeah. It's probably gonna stay at zero for the rest of the year.
Oh, the next episode, guys.
It's gonna stay at zero.
Like the next episode we're recapping in this episode. For multiple times, actually. I can't wait.
Oh, Mitch, you're terrible.
Oh, I know. I'm spoiling everything.
Not in like a, oh, this happens, I know what happens, but like, I just remember watching this the first time with my sister, again, being like 21, and at this point, waiting for it to impress me. And then I remember, like, the end of whatever episode it is where Zuko finds the necklace and being like, oh, ooh. And then when this happened, being like, oh, my God, I ship it so hard.
That the episode where he finds the necklace is actually the Earthbending prison one. So with when Katara meets Haru, like, she loses it. And then he goes, like, on the ship and he picks it up. And he's like, oh, necklace. You know
what? It kind of reminds me of Hermione punching Draco in Prisoner. In the movie.
The moment.
She did that in the book too, right? Yeah.
Of course the only good moment came from the book. This is a different topic.
It's like that sexual tension with the bad guy that you're like, you know that the good guy doesn't want to feel, but they do, and they just don't know how to take it out on the other person, so they kind of just punch him in the face.
Are you trying to ship Hermione Draco on rewatchable of Avatar?
Yeah, I think we're a little off topic now.
Well, okay, I will say what interests me about it is that I don't think this is all very meta, you know, whether or not you pick up on it. I don't think it's supposed to be like Zuko being like, ooh, Katara, I find you so attractive. You know, I think this scene is definitely him trying to manipulate her. You know, trying to get her to tell him, you know, where Aang is, like playing off of her, you know. I mean, there's nothing like respectful about this. It's like, ooh, you want your pretty necklace back? You know, well, just tell me what I want to know. You know, I don't think this is like, this isn't like a healthy, you know, thing.
No, absolutely.
And I don't think it's intentional shipping, maybe again on a meta level, but not from the characters. I don't think either of them are finding each other attractive. Certainly not Katara. Zuko to Zuko. I don't feel Zuko to Katara either, personally.
And isn't it strange that we're shipping, like, preteens, and that's a thing that's very accepted in this fandom to, like, allow that?
Hey, Zuko is 16.
Katara is, like,
that
is
the age
14.
Of consent
Aang?
In Avatar world, okay?
Is Aang, I was trying to figure this out. I should have known this. Is Aang 10?
I think
right
Aang
now?
Is a 12, well, I think.
He's 12.
Yeah, we figured out that he's still very, very young. Like, that's
right.
Why I never got on board with any Aang ships.
It's
like,
just kind of awkward.
Fandom-wise or other, like, I just find it so difficult to ship him with anyone because he's so young. I mean, like, with people like Sokka and Katara and Zuko and characters that we will eventually meet, like, I find it a lot easier because they're closer to 16, or they are 16, and eventually, like, as we go through the show, they go over 16. So for me, like, that's kind of like the cutoff point. And I have the same problem in Teen Wolf with the introduction of Liam, where he's 15, and I just can't, like, I'm just like, not to say anything against people who do ship when they're like younger, because, you know, to each their own, and that's fine. But personally for me, like, if they're under 16, I find it very, very difficult to ship anything.
Well,
just
Danya,
it's okay as long as you're shipping them with people who are approximately the same age. If you're shipping somebody who's 20, that's wrong, and stop.
So you mean Aang Ozai is not shippable?
You are as bad as Kyle. Oh my God, Mitch.
Can you hear my unending ellipsis right now that is just like extending through the
screen? I can. Danya, a quick note about Teen Wolf that you brought up.
Stop talking about Teen Wolf!
Well, it's an actor thing. It's not like a Teen Wolf thing. The fact that a show like Teen Wolf, for instance, will have actors that are in their 20s playing teenagers makes it a little bit less disturbing for me. But with a cartoon character that is their age, because, I mean, if you want to count voice actors, maybe, but that's always extremely skewed. I mean, I obviously, like, Tommy Pickles was played, and Rugrats is played by, like, a 30-year-old, right? So it's not as weird to me in real life Actorville, but cartoons, I really find it very disturbing. It just doesn't, like, for, once again, I wouldn't ship the Rugrats. That's just weird, you know?
that they're in diapers. Wow. Hey, yes. They can't walk.
Hey, let's talk about Appa.
Appa! I love Appa.
See,
all you have to say is Appa, and I'll just melt. Appa. Forget it.
I love Appa. A lot. I want a cuddly Appa.
Do you think that the ending was too convenient with him coming to the rescue?
I love that you clarified that.
I was hoping no one would know that.
Oh no.
God, you're so terrible.
The Monsters, Inc. counter just went down negative 20.
Answer the question.
Yeah, I mean, plot-wise, I don't consider this the strongest of episodes, to be completely honest. But, you know, whatever. I did like the bison thing, the whistle. Like, I did like that came back, because it was like this stupid, silly thing. It's like, oh, Aang has no concept of money, period. You know, and he bought this little thing. Now we have 2 cents instead of 3.
I feel like since they brought it up beforehand, like earlier in the episode, this didn't feel like too convenient to me. So I was fine with it.
Yeah, I was going to say they like threaded that in very, very subtly at the start. I mean, it was very clearly going to be something related to Appa, because it, the whistle is kind of bison shaped. And I really, really liked that. And so it was very clearly, like, even visually, whether you kind of read it as anything else at that particular time, like if you noticed it was bison shaped, or if you just went, oh, it's a whistle.
It doesn't work.
Yeah, it's a whistle that doesn't work. Like, by the time you get until to the does. End of the episode, it's kind of like, oh, that's what it is. So I kind of thought it was a very, very clever little plot device, personally.
Well, why didn't it work until the end of the episode? Like, why didn't Appa just come trampling through the town, wherever they may have tied him up? Because that's also kind of weird.
Didn't Momo get a little bit like, ah, when Aang blows the whistle?
I don't recall.
When he because when he sat on Aang's shoulder, didn't Momo kind of get a little bit like, oh, and kind of like swatted him? I'm pretty sure I remember that. It was like very briefly background kind of secondary animation kind of thing.
Maybe it's distance or something, and they were just close enough to Appa the second time around.
Yeah.
Maybe I imagine that just tell when Aang's in danger.
Oh.
His Appa sense.
Well, you know, that does happen a lot in Atla, that characters seem to just kind of know when the others are in trouble, chakra or energy-wise. So that could make sense, too, because, I mean, I suppose they did some emotional bonding while stuck in that ice cube for 100 years, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, it could, like, and you know that the animals or pets can very, very much be in tune with people's emotions. So, like, they'll know when you're sad, they'll know when you're happy, they'll know, and they'll play off that. So it's a very, very easy thing to kind of accept if that is the case. So
I'd like to believe it was more of an Aang needs me, he's in trouble, emotional sense rather than the whistle, because it just would make me feel better and more cuddly.
But I do also like the whistle.
Yeah, I think we have plenty of evidence that Aang and Appa have a real bond. Or, you know, maybe he just wanted Sokka to finish cleaning his toes. I don't know.
Maybe.
Yeah, it was. Sokka seemed very intent and content in doing that at first. He was like, "You really want me to just like pick mud out of its toes all day?" And Aang's like, "Yeah." He's like, "All right."
I think Sokka was like, "Well, I've never done this before. Like, let's give this a try. I wonder what it's like."
Oh no. Oh god. This episode. Yeah. Okay.
That was not a reference. That was not an innuendo. Oh,
I'll get my mind out of the gutter starting now.
Yeah, no, that's not gonna help going into the next episode.
Right, hi, Bison. Out of the gutter.
Back into the gutter for next. Oh geez.
Favorite scenes. Let's move on quickly before we kind of drag each other through the gutter even more. What was your favorite scene out of this episode? Karen.
The return of the Cabbage Man. I may have like squealed and clapped my hands when he showed back up.
Karen.
I love that continuity that like not only does he say like, "Oh no, my cabbages again," he says this place is worse than Omashu. And like on a network where I feel like you can't necessarily count on them or like airing anything in order or, you know, whatever, just to mention something like that and have no explanation of it, not have like a previously just a little throwaway line that like, "Oh right, they were in Omashu and so was this guy." I don't know. I love that.
Yeah.
What
I
a
love
gift.
That.
Yeah.
Mitch.
So my favorite scene was a cute little moment where it's during the pirate scuffle and there's all that smoke around and Aang's looking for Sokka and then Katara, I assume too. And he just kind of pushes away all the smoke for a moment to like see where where everyone is. And it was kind of like one of those moments in like Scooby-Doo, for instance, where like Scooby would think he's biting the monster, but he's really biting his own leg. Because all the villains were like unveiled at the same point. And they could have been doing like, you know, gymnastics at that point or like having a tea party and we never would know the difference. So it's cute to see everyone like revealed for a second and Aang just like, "Oh crap, I'm right here. Goodbye."
Yeah. If I can't see you, you can't see me.
Oh. Michal?
My favorite scene was definitely when Zuko was like interrogating Katara, because like I said, that was basically the birth of my ship that I shipped for a long time. And it was sexy, I thought.
I think
nobody else in the scene knew it was sexy, but I knew it was sexy.
I think it was the birth of the ship for a lot of people. Though I think the birth of the ship for a lot of people was him just picking up the necklace, because we don't need much to ship anything in fandom.
This is true. This is true.
It's like they don't even need to have to have ever talked to each other to ship it sometimes.
But this time they did.
Yeah.
That's all the truth.
Okay, Bob, put on his sexy voice.
Many ships are born like without conversations even happening between characters, because it's just assumed that they're having like off-screen conversations. But I guess with them, it's impossible because, you know, they're kind of like enemies, and everything that happens between them, we're definitely gonna see.
So for me, my favorite scene was when Sokka and Aang have been like caught by the pirates, and then they're taken along, and Zuko's like, "Hand over the avatar," and Sokka totally plays the pirates and turns them against Zuko. And he's like, hey, no, you totally don't want to hand over the Avatar. I mean, he's going to be worth so much more than that little waterbending scroll. And then obviously turns the tide against Zuko. I thought that was so clever. I thought that was a really, really cool thing.
It's even more clever than you get on, like, I think if you haven't seen it, because the specific reference that Sokka makes is very relevant to Zuko. So I think that was, like, even more potent than maybe Sokka had intended.
Yeah, what, you mean Ozai?
Yeah, you could hand him over to Violet Ozai, you know.
Yeah.
And this kind of begins the disturbing fact that people want a human being in this show, almost in, I wouldn't say like a human trafficking sense, but definitely in like a power sense. It's probably the equivalent of like Aang being like the president of the United States, I guess you could say. Like a person is more of an object to their enemies than they are a person. So, and obviously we see a lot of that in Atla and Korra. It's always as disturbing as it should be that someone is treated more of like an object or a symbol than the person that they are, especially when we get to know the Avatar so intimately in the show. So it just makes you wonder like what they would do if they had the Avatar, what some certain people would do. And my mind's not in the gutter when I'm saying that. I'm meaning more of like, would they try and force a reincarnation into their group or something, you know, like timing wise. And it just, there's a lot of, that's what I've always been really scared of, actually, of people taking the Avatar, that they're going to try and murder them in time to have the birth of someone in their nation quickly enough to create the evil Avatar. And that'd be a really cool plot if they came up with that, wouldn't it?
Number of weeks we've gone without mentioning an evil Avatar. Zero!
Completely horrifying. Wow. This episode
it is terrifying.
So fast. Wow. We're being terrible human beings on this episode. Favorite lines, Karen?
Mine was when Katara just said, shut your air hole. I don't know why, but I just found it really funny.
Mitch?
Mine's when the end of the episode happens and Uncle Iroh looks in his sleeve and goes, oh, Zuko, you're going to love this. It was in my sleeve the whole time. It was so cute because I was like, I feel like Uncle was planning more and he really knew he had the Pie Show thing and he just kind of knew where he had to go for that episode to get everything rolling.
I love Iroh.
And that was a very Dumbledore moment if I've ever seen one, I have to admit.
Mm. Mikal?
That's kind of like I want socks for the Mirror of Erised thing to me, you know?
Right. Yeah. I have two. My cabbages, this place is worse than Amashu, as I said before. And also, like, you know, Katara saying, Aang, this is all my fault. And then Aang saying, no, Katara, it isn't. And then Iroh saying, yeah, it kind of is.
Yeah, that one was mine.
Oh, no. So never mind. You want. Mine was my cabbages.
Yeah, funnily enough, Mikal, my other one was my cabbages. This place is worse than Omaru. But you've taken that first, so I chose that one.
Oh dear, I'm sorry, I didn't notice. Oh man.
It's just Iroh's like deadpan delivery of, yeah, it kind of is. Just that is just, it was just so funny.
Yeah. And also the show acknowledging that, you know?
Yeah.
Like, the fact that, like, something I do love about the show is that the main character doesn't have to have an opinion that the show validates, you know?
Yeah. Cool. Right, we're ready for episode 10, where the show is going to descend into the gutter even more. So, yeah. Episode 10 was called Jet, and our synopsis, which is quite long because there's a lot to cover. So this week in As the World Turns Around Katara's Love Interests, Sokka precludes that Zuko is finding the gang so easily because they're easier to spot whilst flying on Appa. The gang stumbles on foot into a Fire Nation camp, but are saved by a Peter Pan and his Lost Boys. Jet, the leader of this group of misfit toys, has an immediate strong interest in Katara.
That night, Jet invites the gang into his Swiss Family Robinson tree fort and speaks of the ills that the Fire Nation did to most of the members of the group. The gang learns of a nearby Earth Kingdom town that's under the occupation of Fire Nation troops. When Sokka is unimpressed by Jet's revolutionary plans, Jet invites Sokka on an ominous special mission. Unfortunately, this special mission entails jumping an elderly Fire Nation man. Katara and Aang somehow don't yet believe that Jet's scum, so they blissfully help him fill up a dam to prevent Fire Nation fires from destroying the valley. Lo and behold, Sokka overhears the plans to destroy the dam in order to drown all at the Earth Kingdom town filled with the Fire Nation soldiers. Before he has a chance to warn Katara and Aang, Sokka is taken on a mysteriously unexplained long walk. When Aang and Katara realize Jet's deadly intentions, Aang fends off the scoundrel, with Katara dealing a final icy blow. Katara really should have thought to freeze his head, because Jet is still able to send the whistle call out to set off the explosion of the dam. Luckily, Sokka was able to warn the village of their impending doom in time, with the help of the old man Jet mugged there to vouch for Jet's evilness. With Katara's strongest ship yet thoroughly sunk, the gang leaves Jet to think about what he did in his icy prison. Whew! I told you I'd make fine. So Jet, very, very twisted Peter Pan character of this episode, has a mission to take down all of the Fire Nation that's in his path. I mean, do you think that's kind of understandable based on, I guess, what he says is his past, but obviously considering his manipulations of people, you could kind of go one way or another. Do you kind of believe that he lost his family to the Fire Nation, or that he just has like a sweeping general hate of them based on like everything?
I think he lost his family to them, and I think that this was a really good episode to show the difference between the two types of people that have been affected by the Fire Nation. I mean, you could turn out like Jet, who was really scary, actually, by the end of the episode. He was very twisted and manipulative, or you could turn out like Katara and Sokka did, where they obviously don't like the Fire Nation, but they have a better sense of what is right and wrong, and they try to fight the Fire Nation without, you know, destroying everybody in the process. So I think that it was just a really good juxtaposition between those two characters.
I think it's very, very interesting, because the kind of backstory that both Jet has and Katara and Sokka has, like, for all of them, and even I guess a little bit for Aang as well, in terms of like all of the airbenders being wiped out, is for every single one of them that is a villain origin story. And you can either, like you said, you can either go the route of the villain or the route of the kind of the good, the hero kind of thing. And with Jet, what's really, really interesting for him, and what I guess not necessarily makes him a villain in the sense of he wants the whole world to burn kind of thing, is
or drown in this case.
Yeah, is that he sees himself as the hero of his own story. And I love it when, you know, you get villains that are like that, because it gives them a lot more depth, in that they can very, very easily justify what they're doing, and very, very easily justify a loss of life based on like what they believe is the right thing to do. It's like the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or the one, to throw in a Star Trek reference right there.
And now I'm singing. Are you kidding? I'm singing songs from Starship now by Starkid.
Mm-hmm. Totally a Star Trek.
I was thinking of Harry Potter once again, but I guess that's just natural.
Yeah. I mean, what are your general feelings about like just Jet, in terms of like him as an influence to like his little lost boys?
they're cute, and honestly, I think Hal can reference the fact that we had a funny moment during Sept Bender when we were like looking up just like funny image macros of Atla, the series, and one of them was of the characters discovering the ships that they're in. And oddly enough, apparently, like, these Lost Boys are discussed and thought about a lot more than I ever would have thought that they were, because, like, in this episode, they have maybe one or two lines each. And if anything, they just grunt, you know? So it's really odd that the fandom took such a strong liking to, I guess, these very colorful characters, but they're only there for a very brief amount of time.
Then you get that with, like, any fandom. Like, background characters, I think what's really great for them in fandoms and why people latch onto them, because you see it in so many shows, so many. Like, even with Glee with the Warblers and how that kind of exploded. Like, they barely got any lines, but people got such an attachment to them because it's kind of... it's almost like a choose your own story kind of thing. They are characters that you are given just enough to know a rough personality of them. And then you can shape them and shape their story as like a community together. So it kind of becomes this kind of collaborative round robin kind of story between you and other people in the fandom where you kind of come up with your headcanons and then suddenly it's just taken as like a given. And, you know, you see it with the Warblers on Glee, you see it with Danny and Teen Wolf, like, and they become like fandom darlings. So I can completely see where they're coming from in terms of like really latching on to these kids because they're so like even varied, like kind of sizes and shapes, and you know, you can put your own personalities onto them. So I can definitely see why people latch onto the background characters like that.
I feel bad for these kids actually, because I feel like most of them, maybe even all of them, really aren't as twisted as Jet was, and yet under his leadership they've been kind of molded into these people who, you know, like, because at one point in the episode they do kind of question him and he's like, no, like, this is what we need to do to be able to achieve our objective. And they're kind of like, oh, okay, well, we'll listen to you. It always turns out fine in the end. I think they're very naive. And I think that it's sad that, you know, otherwise good kids are probably being twisted because of what he's doing to them.
Well, I know, like, in last week's episode, you know, Natalie and you guys were talking about, like, not liking the Earth Nation. And I agree that the Earth Nation can be really hard to like. But when you see things like this and you see things like, you know, just the general, like, day-to-day life in the Earth Kingdom, I think it's a real illustration of, like, this is a nation that has been at war for 100 years. They are losing this war. There are orphans and widows and widowers and, you know, soldiers everywhere. And they're in a really rough state. And that doesn't lead to a situation where that brings out the best in people. You know, it just doesn't. Like, Jed is wrong here. Jed is doing a very bad thing. He's wiping out his own people to try and wipe out soldiers. But at the same time, it's like Jet is kind of bamboozling these kids because they are looking for somebody to take care of them. And probably he's looking for someone to take care of him on a certain level. And that's where that came from. So I think, like, when I think about the Earth Kingdom, I always try and think of them in the context of what the war has done to them. And obviously, like, that's not any individual Fire Nation soldier's fault, you know. But it's kind of like this, the evil is never from one source, you know. Yeah, that's what I think.
There's evil on every side. Like, you know, you get people trying to do good and they're trying to fight for their freedom and for everything, but you still get people who kind of twist it to their own gain kind of thing. And I think it's very, very interesting to show that, you know, there are people who will do terrible things on both sides of this war.
Mm-hmm. Even someone who is, like, so attractive, and I don't mean that in a physical sense necessarily. I mean, like, Jed is an extremely dynamic character, and, you know, seeing him, like, just flipping through those Fire Nation people and everything, like, he is very single-minded, and he's, like, very devoted to his cause. And I think, as frustrating as it is to be, like, on Sokka's side, obviously, and be like, no, 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 you're wrong to, you know, Aang and Katara, but you understand how that situation has kind of evolved and why, you know, we have these lost children who are, like, so utterly devoted to him, you know, because he is what they have.
Yeah, I mean, he's very charismatic. Mm-hmm. It's so easy to fall into his kind of spell. So, yeah, I can kind of see why they would flock to him. And it's kind of like, even the in the traditional sense, if you take, like, the Disney kind of side of Peter Pan out of it, like, I mean, even a little bit with the Disney Peter Pan, actually, when you think about it, it's very, very kind of, Peter Pan is a very manipulative character. He's not a good character. So, kind of even the themes that it's taking on that, I think is very, very interesting, because it's not excusing that. I mean, even you even see it in, like, Once Upon a Time, like, Peter Pan is not a nice guy. I mean, you kind of put him across like that, and he's kind of set up to be like, he's this very charismatic, very likable, very kind of fantasy-esque kind of ideal. And then when you really, really get down to it and look past everything, he's not as great as you see on the surface and you're first led to believe. So I thought that was a very, very, it's like a very, very clever take on Peter Pan and bringing it to an audience again for me. And I mean, I guess, like, Katara's kind of like his Wendy in a way. Like, bringing her in and trying to bring her into the fold.
Which isn't ironic that this episode juxtaposes the pirate episode.
Yeah. Like, when you kind of look at it, I mean, did you guys kind of, do you ship it? I'm just going to be blunt and ask it. Did you ship it at any point?
Oddly enough, somehow, yes. And I don't know if that's from a non-spoiler standpoint, from a poker face standpoint, I should say. I don't know if that's the retrospect of watching this episode again. I found myself as entranced as Katara was in, I guess, just his proactive action and how much that already fit along with how Katara acts and thinks, because she is going to steal that waterbending scroll because she wants to proactively learn herself, and she may lie and manipulate her way to get it and to justify having it, but she's still going to do what she wants. And her and Jet do have that quality very much in common. So to me, I saw that they could relate to that, or that Katara could try and maybe, I know you shouldn't try and fix someone in a relationship, but perhaps reel him in a little bit more and put him more toward, like, guide him toward the light, I suppose, and show him that, minus stealing from pirates, that you really shouldn't murder, maim, and kill, and that there are better ways to live your life, and we can do it together if we kind of just take each other under our wings to protect each other. So that's where I found myself shipping it. But like I said, that's not looking into the future. That's just strictly looking at this one episode, you know, and not knowing anything else about this entirety of the series and Korra and all that. I just, that's how I feel.
Well, do you think that, like, Jack, it could have gone the other, it could so easily have gone the other way, in that, like, where you think Katara could have reeled him in, Jack could have really pushed her further in terms of, like, taking those very, very small, selfish, self-serving kind of aspects of Katara and twisting them, because we know he's very manipulative. We know he's very charismatic. Like, he could have really, like, twisted Katara into a different kind of character, taken that and pushed it further. So it could have worked. It could have gone either way, really.
I mean, I don't ship it because I don't think that there's any honesty there, really. I mean, no, Tara is completely at his mercy, you know, down to what the reality of the situation is. She's at his mercy. But yes, I do think that Tara has a lot of anger issues. I think she has that's part of the reason why she feels sympathetic to him, because he's like, oh, my family was destroyed by the Fire Nation. Oh, so was mine, you know. So, yes, I do think that there could have been a very unhealthy tango there. But no, I definitely can't ship that.
I'm the same. I don't ship it. Karen, how did you feel?
Maybe, like, in the first 2 minutes, and then I was just totally done with him. I was like, no, there's something wrong with this guy. So it ended pretty quickly for me.
Yeah. I mean, Karen, how are you kind of feeling about, like, the real focus on bringing in kind of love interests for Katara, like, starting to thread them through? We had it a little bit with Haru a little bit earlier, and who was it who brought up, like, the kind of the very, very subtle hints of, like, her and Aang earlier again? And then we've got bits with Zuko, and now we've got Jet. So how are you kind of feeling about that?
I mean, I think it's interesting. I would like to see some more of those relationships maybe solidify, especially since, you know, I always like redemptive stories. So if it happens to be with Zuko or with Jet or something, like, if that's going to happen, I would love to see them sort of come to their senses, become better people, you know, not necessarily for her, maybe for themselves, but if that's how they get together, like, that would be kind of cool. But I like that it's clearly not the focus of the series. And I think it's really important that going forward, hopefully it doesn't become one of those things, because while I'm interested in seeing her or even some of the other characters, you know, come into a relationship, that's not really what I care about at this point. I care much more about Aang and his story as the Avatar and trying to learn the different bending skills and, you know, saving the world. So I'm kind of like give or take, I guess.
World saving over shipping?
Yeah. I mean, isn't that how it should be anyway? Unless it's like obviously a romantic, like if it's a romance, then yeah, that's going to be the focus. But I think that relationships should always sort of like be an addition to the main plot. Like that shouldn't be what drives the story unless it's a romance, because otherwise you're losing, you know, the point of it, that he is the Avatar, that he's so out of his element. Haha. And he has to save the world. And, you know, if there are relationships along the way, that's great, but I never want that to take away from, you know, the focus of him and his duty as the Avatar.
I agree with Karen.
That little clip and just like insert that into every single shipping Tumblr post of Atla ever, the world would be a better place.
I would probably be murdered. I mean, I don't even know the fandom, but I know people and their shipping are very
passionate.
Sure, that's the word I was looking for. I was gonna say terrifying, but yeah, let's not do that. I would like to live till the end of the week.
You guys can probably back me up on the fact that we've probably hit the biggest ship that's contended so far, Zutara, haven't we?
I think.
Like we've gotten over that molehill, and it's gonna start. It's gonna continue. But I think we've done a lot of progress in just, I think, analyzing that in a very logical way.
Yes.
We can say that much at least.
Moving on. I mean,
it's hard to talk about it, you know, because it's like at this point, it is all very, you know, theoretical, and like the characters have barely met. I mean, at this point, like, I think it just at this point in the story, it makes more sense to ship Jatara than it does to ship Zutara. Obviously that, you know, I don't, but, yeah, I mean, I do kind of like the idea, like, of what that thing that they did with Katara, like, sparkling and looking at Jed and everything, because to me that was, like, a big fat sign, like, don't ship this, you know, Katara's into him, don't ship this, you know. I think we weren't supposed to see Aang and Katara's actions as logical in this episode. I think we were supposed to question them and be on Sokka's side, and that kept building, and the more Jet kept lying, and I mean, just so smooth, like, when they were like, you know, oh, hey, where's Sokka? And he was like, oh, yeah, he I sent him on a mission. Like, just no, like, yeah. I mean,
Sokka really, really kind of, I mean, obviously he wasn't attracted or fooled by Jet in the same way as the others, because he saw it as a more objective kind of thing. So he got some really great moments in this episode. Like, I really, really love Sokka in this episode, like, a lot. Like, I think much more than Katara, I think between this episode and the previous episode, like, his morals in terms of what he believes is right and wrong are probably more on the right track than Katara's, personally. And I think he really, really shines in this episode. I love Sokka so much in this episode. What about you guys? How did you feel about Sokka kind of becoming, I guess, becoming the focus of this episode? This is a very, very Sokka kind of centric episode in terms of him driving the plot and becoming, like, almost the hero of the whole thing.
I loved it because I feel like a lot of times he gets the short end of the stick, and he's very sarcastic and he likes picking on other people, and he ends up, you know, coming out of those situations looking dumb a lot of times. And I think that's just part of his humor, and his role on the show is to sort of be, you know, like the comedic relief. But I think that he has a lot of skills. I mean, sometimes he looks stupid, but he isn't. I mean, he is very clever. He's a good fighter. He just happens to go up against a lot of people who, you know, are either benders or have been fighting a lot longer than him because he's still a kid. And the fact that he was able to be the leader in this episode was really nice to see, actually. I really like his character, and it was cool to see him come out on top. But I also like how at the end, you know, he ended up flying in the wrong direction. I think it's really important that he isn't always right, and that he's not perfect, and that sometimes, you know, he still messes up. And it was just a funny and cute moment.
Yeah, I love that. I love that he was flying in the wrong direction as well. Like, that makes me crack up. Like, as someone who constantly goes in the wrong direction, even when they've got Google Maps up, that amused me.
Yeah, I mean, I love Sokka. He's one of my favorite characters, and I agree that this episode is kind of one where he gets to, like, stand out a little bit. And it's also funny because, like, we haven't met a lot of people who are more paranoid than Sokka, and we do in Jet. And, like, it's interesting to have that contrast and be like, you know, Sokka takes things too far sometimes, but as a general life approach, he does not take things too far. Jet takes things too far all the time. And, you know, I really like that. And I like that, you know, Aang can kind of see Sokka's helpfulness. And, you know, I think this is something that they'll learn from.
I just have so many feelings about Sokka in this episode. So many. I mean, I thought it was really.
Is anybody shipping Jaka? Jataka?
I hope not. I really hope not. These are not ministers, kind of, as is often said in many hyped podcasts. You cannot ship siblings in any show.
No. Jataka, not Jatara. Not I don't even know what Sokka and Katara's ship would be, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about Jet and Sokka.
Oh, Jotaro, well,
I mean,
got
it's that kind of rival, I hate you, but I love you kind of thing. So, you know, there's totally a basis for it there. It's, I don't ship it, but I kind of see where you're coming from.
Oh, I don't ship it. I'm just saying, I'm sure there are people who do.
Oh, there's fanfic of it. Isn't that like one of the rules of the internet? Or is that like there's porn of it, no exceptions? Yeah, there's porn of it, no exceptions.
Yes, indeed. That is the rule, and it's unfortunate sometimes because,
And even though, like, obviously we see Aang take a little bit of a backseat and kind of, like, he's not really the focus in this episode, and you kind of see him again kind of going around and being very, very childlike on, like, the zip lines and going around and being very like, oh, this is great, this is awesome, let's kind of stay here in this treetop kind of village forever. Yeah. But then when he does come back into the episode a bit more after, like, Jet's true intentions are revealed, because, like, he eventually puts two and two together and thankfully comes up with four and figures out what Jet is going to do with the dam. But then that resulting kind of fight, that I love. Like, I just love the fight sequences on this show. And the same with the previous episode, with, like, that entire fight sequence at the end of the episode and into this one. I absolutely love all the fight sequences.
Yeah, very beautiful. And, I mean, it's funny because at the end of every Atla/Korra episode, there seems to just be, like, almost like a fan service fight where you're just like, okay, I needed a little bit of action in this episode. But it's never done in a way that I'm like, ugh, seen this interaction before, I'm over this. It's always like, this is a legitimate culmination of the plot, and I am excited to see these characters duke it out, because this was the way that the drama was playing out. It wasn't forced, it was very natural, because, I mean, Aang's probably either trying to stop a large disaster from happening, or he's really upset from a personal standpoint, someone, so. But he's usually on the defensive, like he was in this fight, so, it was interesting. I thought that he started to take the offensive against Jet eventually, even after he said he wasn't going to hurt him. He definitely did hurt him. He, like, tossed him off the tree to die. He was lucky he, like, caught a vine, you know?
Well, I think that was after, right? That was after he realized that, you know, Jet was up to, like, really bad stuff. Unless I'm forgetting the details really of the episode bad that I just watched, like, an hour ago.
It was almost, well, I probably shouldn't make a Harry Potter reference, so I won't, but I'll let people's imaginations run of where I was going to go with the hero almost killing someone because they were angry.
He killed my parents! Okay, I'm done.
And more.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, do you think it's justified and reasonable force based on learning that someone's intentions is the mass murder of an entire village?
Well, is that down to, like, a capital punishment question?
Oh, well, that I'm asking your opinion. You know, how do you feel about it? Like,
does he deserve to die because he was killing the other people?
Or had the intention to do it? He hadn't done it at that point. Like, right.
Well, you're right. He hadn't done his whistle. Yeah, so interesting. Yeah, it's funny that Aang was after him in such a murderous force. I feel that he could have disabled him a little bit easier than rather than putting such fatal blows toward him.
What about you, Karen? How did you feel about it?
I don't know. It was bad.
Insightful, Karen.
Thanks.
I don't know, like, I think it's nice to kind of, like, figure out where Aang's lines are sometimes. Like, what could push him over the edge? Because he's still quite, like, he's brought up as a monk, so he's a far calmer person than most, but it's very, very interesting to see what sort of things will push him over the edge a little bit more. So I think the very real and present danger that Jet could have, like, killed so many people just to get to, like, one or two, or a very, very small number. He was very, very willing to wipe out an entire village to do it. I think it's very, very interesting to see what pushes and drives Aang to go on a more offensive kind of path.
And it's very cowardly of Jet to do it in that fashion, too, because if he really had beef with just those given soldiers, he probably could have found some creative way in his brain to just take out them. I mean, apparently everyone's stupid enough to run through the forests that are inhibited by these lost boys, because I'm sure word's getting around that if you set up an encampment in this village, you're going to die. Because like, it's probably like, you know, the equivalent of like the Forbidden Forest for that earthbending kingdom. It's like, why would you, earthbending town, like, why would you even bother going in there in the first place, elderly man? You must have had a really important reason.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine, like, for example, the old man who kind of goes through, I would imagine that it's, like, the path through the forest is probably a very, very quick way to get on, like, trade routes and get from point A to point B, because there was a path going through it, so I would imagine that it was set up for a reason. I think maybe the way that Jet has kind of positioned his lost boys to be able to kind of ambush them in places was very, very thoughtful and very purposeful. Like, mm-hmm. they're in that forest for a reason, because there's a path going through it. So it's very clearly a point A to point B kind of path. So, mm-hmm. But like, in terms of kind of getting them, like getting the Fire Nation to come to them, I'm not sure that the Fire Nation soldiers that are in, like, that have taken over that Earth Kingdom village are, like, stupid enough to fall for a ploy by a kid, essentially. Not, like, they've been there, they've clearly been there a long time, both Jet and the Lost Boys and the Fire Nation soldiers, so I imagine that they've probably attempted something different before. And it clearly hasn't worked. So this is kind of his, you know what, I just want to wipe the slate clean and let's just get rid of them all kind of thing.
It's, you know, actually, it's a good metaphor, I'd say, for something like nuclear warfare, because it's kind of like both sides have the ability to completely annihilate either. Like the Fire Nation troops could have easily burnt down the forest, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same point, it's kind of like whoever pulls the trigger first. So it's interesting to me now that both parties have survived, what the Fire Nation is going to do to Jet and Co. after. Would they start just, if I was them, I might be forced to burn down the forest to get rid of Jet and his gang, because they obviously are acting in extreme mass murderer force, you know, like they're going to kill innocent people along with it. So it's like you dodge the enemy's nuclear bomb, now toss your own back at them, almost. So it's like Jet definitely, he started a war, I'd say, here. And it's going to be interesting as I remember or see that unfold as the series continues, if we hear some more about that. That'd be really great.
Yeah. Let's move on, like, a little bit quicker, because we still got favorite scenes and favorite lines to get through as well. But obviously Katara kind of finishes that up and kind of goes through it and freezes him, and then they kind of, that's kind of it. Like, she kind of breaks free of his, like, manipulations, and yeah, Sokka kind of saves the day as well at the end and saves the entire village. So yeah, let's move in to favorite scenes. So Karen, what was your favorite scene?
That was a good segue, because mine is Sokka saving the day. I just love that he was the one that they had to be like, well, oh my god, you know, Sokka, maybe he got there first, then everything blows up and you're kind of like, what's going on? And then he kind of rides up and he was like, yeah, I warned them all, it's cool, I got it, guys, don't worry about it.
Yeah, Mitch?
So my favorite scene is this cute moment when oh, no, I was thinking of my favorite quote, but it kind of fits in with what Karen was saying, too. I think that's where my mind was leading. But also, my favorite scene was when Jet and Aang are popping in and out of the trees, and there's like a little like harp that happens as they both take their turn. And I thought it was a really pretty moment, and it really, it's kind of one of those moments of Atla that reminds you that nature is actually in the forefront here, and that this other action is kind of in the background while, you know, like they're as the world turns, Atla is going on. But it's mostly, I think, nature and the elements that should be the most important part.
Mikhail?
I really liked Jet's speech at the treehouse when they're kind of, you know, they're going over the events of the day and finding Aang, Katara, and everybody. Because I just thought that was masterfully written, and he is very clearly he has these people like wrapped around his little finger, and it's very impressive to watch, and it's very understandable why Aang and Katara kind of fall under his spell. And I think that was a really good setup to like, hey guys, this is Jet, this is what he's up to. Really well done.
Mine was the whole scene at the start where Sokka's kind of talking about his instincts, and then they like Katara just starts ribbing him about his instincts and just really, really just poking, like the way that siblings do. Like petty sibling bickering is like my favorite thing in TV shows. Like I absolutely love it. Having a younger brother, we totally did stuff like that to each other when we were growing up. We would push each other's buttons like that. So I really, really love that scene a lot. Favorite lines. Let's go back to Karen.
Sokka's just jealous he doesn't have an arrow. That's what Aang said to him, and I'm jealous I don't have an arrow, so I can understand.
Mitch?
Mine is a quick line of a little girl in the Earth Kingdom town that witnesses the entirety of her town being flooded over, yet she's just so excited to see her ball. So when she picks it up, she just goes, Mrs. Pretty! And to me, it was great because I really forgot that the town really wasn't annihilated. So the first time around, I was thinking of all the children and things that were drowned in that village, especially from, like, you know, Aang and Katara's reactions. And then you see, like, this doll floating right after their realization that it really just happened, right? And it reminded me of, like, you know, when the evil guy in Mulan picks up that ratty doll kind of deal. And like the burnt down village. It was the same kind of feeling. So this one was, it was like a better version of what happened in Mulan, I suppose.
Oh.
How Mulan should have ended, you could say.
It's okay. This little girl wasn't slaughtered.
Yeah. Mikhail?
When Sokka is trying to convince Katara and Aang to leave, and he goes, you know, like, Jed's terrible, we're leaving. And so Sokka goes, we're leaving. And Katara goes, but I made him this hat.
ugly hat.
Dumbass hat. It is so ridiculously funny. And so ugly. Not related to anything else that Sokka is saying or that has happened in the episode. It's just so hilariously random. I love it.
The Katara's just like holed herself up somewhere in this like tree village, and she's made a
hat. I know what he'll like. He'll like a hat.
So ridiculous. Mine is
just love hats.
Yeah. my favorite line is actually out of my favorite scene, which was Katara going, I don't know, Aang. Why don't you ask Sokka's instincts? They seem to know everything. Like, I just
awesome.
It was that one, and it was even like the one that was right after it as well, which I can't remember off when Aang's asking like someone to like, oh, these thief bags are like really, really heavy, and she's like, why don't you ask Sokka's instincts to carry them? That whole scene, absolutely love it.
That was awesome.
We have no listener feedback for this week.
I know. It makes me sad when people don't comment on the posts in Hypeable, because I keep checking them slightly obsessively to be like, what do people think? And then some people don't comment, and I'm like, oh, people didn't think anything.
Yeah, but then, so guys, we love your feedback. So if you've
probably
been listening
to an unhealthy level.
Yeah, probably. That's quite accurate. So if you, like, please leave us feedback, or even, like, at reply us on Twitter. I mean, you can email us whatever you want, however you want to give us feedback. So again, our email is rewatchable.podcast@gmail.com. Our Twitter is @re_watchable. The show notes will go up on this post on hyperbole.com, or alternatively, leave us an iTunes review. We read everything. We read all our emails. We read every single app message you send us. We read every comment on hyperbole.com. We read every iTunes review. So leave some for us. We love looking through them and addressing them at the end of each episode. So come and engage with us. It's fun, I promise.
And fun fact, I do not think that there are any reviews that talk about the Atla rewatch yet. But obviously, we still have plenty of time for that.
Yeah, we're very, very early on.
You can be the first.
You could be the first. Go, go, go.
Because we are going on until we decided after Christmas, I think it was. Right, Karen?
This is going to be on for ages, right?
The Avatar rewatch?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's
Until February.
Yeah.
So I guess you guys have some time to settle into our voices, personalities, and analysis before you write a little iTunes review.
But yeah, I guess that's it. We've got through the whole episode, so we're done. So I guess I'll say bye. I was Donya. Did I introduce myself at the end, at start of the episode?
No, that's why I said something, and then you just started yelling at me, and you never did it anyway, so it was pointless.
Wow, okay, so you kind of get me now, so bye, I was Donya.
I'm Karen.
I'm Mitch.
I'm also Donya. Oh, no, I mean, I'm Mia.
We should have just all signed off as Donya.
Bye, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Lameo.